There was turmoil between labor and management in 1967. For the auto industry, it was that time again.
We have made it very clear. We do not want more than our share, but we are determined to settle for nothing less than our share.
Walter Reuther, president of the United Auto Workers and top bargainer for the men on the line. It was a year for negotiating new contracts. It took 5 months, and Ford felt it first and worst.
We were most disappointed that the company, after 8 hours, came up with a letter that had the standards of a high school essay contest. And we were very disappointed. And because of their refusal to arbitrate, there's a strike in process.
Retorted an angry Henry Ford II.
I deplore the action of the UAW in forcing Ford into this situation. I am sorry that we do not have laws that effectively prevent the use of this kind of bludgeon against the public interest. But I do not for 1 minute regret our decision to take this strike rather than surrender to an unrealistic set of union demands.
But the 160,000 Ford workers at 91 installations remained off the job for a total of 61 days. Nearly $6 million a day in wages and benefits went down the drain. When it ended, the UAW leaders said it was worth it.
I'm very happy to announce, on behalf of myself and Ken Bannon and the National Ford Committee, that we have concluded a very historic agreement. And I salute and congratulate the Ford workers for the spirit and the solidarity which has made possible this great victory.
But all was not solidarity in the union. Skilled tradesmen were at odds with the leadership. They wanted more now. At a Ford council meeting, they let their feelings be known. WKNR's Eric Smith was there.
Mr. Reuther, you surprised at that reception?
Look, there are 160,000 Ford workers on strike. Anybody can mobilize 25 people to shout no.
The Ford agreement was ratified. To the worker, the strike had won increases of over a dollar an hour for the next 3 years. To the Ford Motor Company, the cost was staggering. In the third quarter, the company reported losses of $74 million and was still struggling to win back lost sales. Next, the UAW went to Chrysler and General Motors. The pattern had been set, the contracts were reached, and Walter Reuther was happy.
It's a very rewarding thing, educating management. We go in there and they say insurmountable, impossible, impractical, unworkable, economically unsound, socially undesirable, and then we get them to do it.
For the UAW, it was another milestone year. There was other labor trouble around the nation. In July, the nation's railroads were shut down by machinists. The next day, Congress put through a bill to end it. A strike by steel haulers spread over 8 states. It lasted 9 weeks and was marred by violence. There was a rubber strike, and 50,000 workers in the copper industry walked out in midsummer. They're still out. And at the start of the school year, Detroiters and suburbanites alike were faced with a strike of another dimension. Teachers, thousands of them, hit the bricks, and school bells were silenced for 500,000 Michigan youngsters. The issue was simple: money. The districts affected ranged from the posh suburbs of Birmingham and Bloomfield to the downriver communities of Ecorse and Gibraltar. The biggest was Detroit. The militant lady leader of Detroit's Federation of Teachers, Mrs. Mary Ellen Reardon, defied the urgent pleadings of an already paying community, hailing her flocks to the sidewalks.
I'd like to make something very, very clear. We are not going on strike. We are taking an extended summer recess.
Said school spokesman, there was no money. Dr. Norman Drackler, superintendent of Detroit schools, put it this way for WKNR.
There isn't any money to meet both the demands made by the teachers as well as the services and commitments which we had made to the public in terms of additional teachers, reduction of class size, repairing of old buildings, and constructing classrooms. We simply cannot do both.
The teachers staged demonstrations, picketed, and drew the ire of weary parents and tired city officials, but the melody lingered long.
Solidarity!
As for the youngsters, vacation had lasted long enough.
Let's say they strike all year, then we're all going to be a year behind. Then what's the world going to come to if no one has school anymore?
Well, we pay a lot of taxes for this, and, well, they shouldn't get a raise every year.
They shouldn't, because we want to get back in school and not be dropouts like they are.
Nearly 2 weeks after the scheduled start of school, the break came. A new two-year contract with an $850 raise and smaller classes. The teachers left the bricks, and the kids hit the books. The end of the Detroit struggle did not signal the finale of other teacher walkouts. The Michigan Federation began needling the governor for his frequent out-of-state trips and lack of involvement in the strikes. At one point, union spokesman Tom Hill told WKNR,
"Last time I saw the governor was on television last week. He was judging a bubblegum contest at the Michigan State Fair. We would hope with 500,000 kids out that he would begin to work and get in here and do something about it."
Back in Michigan, the governor's fabled temper flared when he was accused of failing to keep promises to aid education. In a meeting with union officials, the governor's anger spilled.
"Now, the thing you completely overlooked, and I resent it with all the intensity of my being, school aid support statewide has dropped to about 40%. Of total school expenditures in this state when I took public office. In the brief period I've been in public office, we've raised it to above 50%.
Finally, the Michigan teacher walkouts were settled, at least temporarily. In some areas, the teachers taught while the courts pondered the problems of public employee strikes. In June of 67, Detroit's finest stopped writing traffic tickets. The move was accepted gratefully by millions of Detroit drivers, not so by the mayor.
"I don't propose to tolerate it. The commissioner has bent over backwards, literally, in the last several weeks in attempting to resolve this impasse. And since the Detroit Police Officers Association shows no inclination to do anything about it, we're going to take what action we can take."
The police were attempting to make a point. They were in a budding labor organization, the DPOA. They wanted, they said, more money, and the city didn't have it. 40 officers were sent back to walking a beat. Still, the ticket slowdown continued. And then a new virus suddenly appeared. They called it the blue flu. It reached epidemic proportions, but only among police. They called in sick by the hundreds. There was talk of National Guard and state police help. The city went to court. An injunction was issued, but it didn't work. In an interview with WKNR labor reporter Mike O'Neill, Police Association President Carl Parcell tossed the injunction aside.
"The injunction says that the officers will not force the men into not writing tickets, and I never forced them into not writing tickets before. It says that I will not force them into getting sick, and I never forced them into getting sick. So the injunction doesn't mean anything. We haven't done anything like that to start with."
"You mean an injunction can't stop a man from getting sick?"
"You said it, and that's right. An injunction cannot stop an officer from getting sick."
The blue flu spread, and Police Commissioner Girardin took action.
"We've canceled furloughs and leave days, and our men are working 12 hours as a result of this unusual illness that seems to pervade."
Wives and children took to the sidewalks in support of the boys in blue, but the city held fast. There wasn't any money available. Finally, lengthy bargaining sessions produced an agreement on non-economic matters giving status to the union. And as for the money, that issue went to fact-finding. A report is still awaited to see if there's money to cure that rare disease, blue flu. On November 15th, the presses at the Detroit News rolled to a stop. The next day, the Free Press closed. A strike of Teamsters closed the news. Under a publisher's agreement, the Free Press voluntarily quit printing. There appeared little hope of an early resumption of publication. Late in the year, Teamsters turned down a final newspaper offer on wages. The shadow of a growing crime rate spread across Michigan, as it did the nation in 1967. The Attorney General, Frank Kelly, said it was organized.
"We are establishing in the Attorney General's office an organized crime division. As far as I know, it will be the first of its kind in the nation. It is being charged with the following responsibility: to mobilize all of the resources of law and law enforcement available to the state and to apply them with all the vigor we can muster against organized crime in Michigan."
The state's organized crime division had some success during the year, among them the breakup of a massive gambling ring. In Detroit, grocers were alarmed. Robberies were on the rise, and many storekeepers had been shot. They banded together, armed themselves, and even attended a gun clinic to learn the fine points. And they battled the bandits. But, said top cop Girardin,
I'm fearful of it because they're going to get themselves killed. Now, so far, in the last few weeks, the number of merchants who have shot the holdup people, the merchants are ahead.
The citizens clamored for protection. In Dearborn, a stop-and-frisk law was approved, allowing police to question anyone they suspected. Said the city's fiery mayor, Orville Hubbard,
I think the people are fed up way up above their ear line of the muggings and the robberies and the murders and the hijacking and all this thing that's going on. It's caused riots. I think all races of people feel that way about it.
The image of lawlessness continued to grow. The murder rate hit an all-time high. And of all the murders, none was more cruel than the deaths of two little sisters in the suburb of Westland. Debbie and Kim Crowther were brutally attacked, maimed, and strangled in a field near their home as they left school. A 14-year-old boy had been glue-sniffing before he trapped the girls. A shaken neighbor, Mrs. Mary Miller, told newsman Eric Smith the story.
What was it like back there, Mrs. Miller?
It was terrible. Their clothes all over and their shoes beside them. Even their shoes and socks off.
What else was in the area? You mentioned something about glue tubes.
Yes, right over here about maybe 100 feet from where the bodies are. There was about 50 to 75 glue tubes at least.
Under the law, the 14-year-old could not be tried. He was committed to a juvenile home until he's 18. On the afternoon of December 4th, on Detroit's near west side, the siege on Stanford Street began. 62-year-old Eugene Ector, an auto worker, barricaded himself in his home. He was armed with an M1 rifle and a pistol. With him were his wife, her two daughters, a son, and a grandson. Ector fired several shots in the home and twice fired through the windows. Police cordoned off the area. An older daughter rushed to the scene. She crouched near the home using a police bullhorn.
Daddy!
The poignant cries of the daughter helped. Ector agreed to allow other family members inside. But it would be 18 long hours before police were able to grab Ector and free the family. No one was hurt. Ector was committed. Friends said he had changed since a son was shot during the rioting. A son later found innocent of looting. Time was an issue in Michigan to bring the year. Congress had okayed a Uniform Time Act. All states were to go on daylight time unless the state legislature passed an exemption. Michigan's did. The pressure came from theater owners, restaurants, and mainly the Farm Bureau, whose president, Dan Reed, argued,
We're now on daylight saving time, really. We're on Eastern Standard Time, while 96% of the state of Michigan lies in the Central Time Zone.
In Detroit and other larger communities, daylight time was desired, and some felt needed. Dwight Havens of Detroit's Board of Commerce.
All of our business procedures in general are tuned to an Eastern time zone. From our point of view, what with the remainder of the Eastern time zone going with the established Uniform Time Act, we'd like to see Michigan do same.
A petition drive to get the issue on the ballot was successful, and finally, nearly 2 months after the rest of the nation, Michigan's clocks were moved ahead an hour. People decide in November of 68. Most Michigan residents remember 1967 as the year the state took a bite of their paycheck. Fiscal reform finally came. A 2.6% levy on personal income. The first bite came in October. It raked in $24 million in the first month, and by next June, state officials hoped to net $171 million. For Governor Romney, it climaxed years of trying for fiscal reform. In the world of sports, the Detroit Tigers got the fans in the ballpark through the summer. They were in and out of first place for most of the season and never too far off the pace. And as the season was ending, the Tiger fans had their fingers crossed.
Tigers, my team. I don't care what nobody else say. I pull for the Tigers. Even when they're going down, I pull for them. Tigers are my team, and I just hope to be here. Where else can I go see a World Series?
Not Detroit. They lost the last game of the season and missed a playoff, and the Red Sox took the marbles. Later, the Cardinals took the Red Sox in the series. The Detroit Lions named a new coach, Joe Schmidt, and Mel Farr and Lem Barney took rookie honors with the Lions. Michigan State, once powerful, recorded the most disastrous season in 50 years. They won only 3 of 10 games. In April, an attractive middle-aged woman stepped off an airliner in New York. She was Svetlana Stalin, daughter of the late Russian dictator. She had defected communism in search of freedom. Would she become a citizen?
I think that before the marriage, it should be love. So if I will love this country and this country will love me, then the marriage will be settled, but I cannot say now.
Stalin's daughter later published a book. It told of the terrors of a totalitarian state. Another woman made news, Anne Pellegrino, a slight attractive blonde from Saline, Michigan. She flew a vintage 1937 airplane on the route taken by the late Amelia Earhart. The flight was successful. There was tragedy in the space race. The Russians lost cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov. A capsule burned on the launching pad at Cape Kennedy as tests were being made for the Apollo flight. Dead, astronauts Virgil Gus Grissom and Ed White, rookie Roger Chaffee. Chaffee's father summed it up as he said goodbye.
God bless you, Rog, Gus, Ned. The price of progress comes high at times.
Many others won't be with us in 1968. Among them, Francis Cardinal Spellman, Harold Holt, Conrad Adenauer, John Nance Garner, Clement Attlee, J. Robert Oppenheimer, Carl Sandburg, Henry Luce, John Masefield, Bernard Fall, Dorothy Parker, Henry Kaiser and Alfred Krupp, Joseph Kowalski, Claire Hoffman, Harold Volkema, Ed Connor, Al Barber, Richard Weber, Joseph Gillis, James Nunley, Basil Rathbone, Paul Muni, Spencer Tracy, Vivian Lee, Misha Elman, Nelson Eddy, Claude Rains, Ann Sheridan, Bert Lahr, and Paul Whiteman. And the nameless are among the numbered. Some skydivers jumped over the wrong target and drowned in Lake Erie. A bridge collapsed at Point Pleasant, West Virginia. 36 bodies have been recovered. Airliners crashed in Ohio. In 1 month, 53 died. A department store fire in Brussels, Belgium, killed 129. Fire swept the aircraft carrier Forrestal. 34 sailors were killed. 1967 was also a year of flower children and paper dresses and microskirts and Boulder movies and LSD and marijuana. There was the permissive society. There were gurus and musical groups with names, Stone Ponies, Strawberry Alarm Clock, Lovin' Spoonful, and The Cream. And there was some question as to what was thrown off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And there were trips and happenings and people who blew their mind. But we managed all 12 months. There were other events that deserve mention. In Greece, where democracy was born, it died. There was a crisis over Cyprus. In Cleveland, Ohio, and Gary, Indiana, men named Stokes and Hatcher became mayor. They were Negroes. In California, the good ship Lollipop sank. Adam Clayton Powell and Thomas Dodd hit upon hard times. Che Guevara and George Lincoln Rockwell were gone. Cassius Clay said no to the army and lost a crown. An obstinate Congress said no to a surcharge unless the fiscal axe was wielded. It wasn't. There was Hollybush and Glassboro. A commissioner named Girardin retired. There was a highway department probe that didn't get off the ground. There were summer floods that caused problems, and there was a Detroit winter with more than 50 inches of snow. There was a New Orleans attorney named Garrison. There was a ship called the Torrey Canyon that sprung a leak and oiled the British beaches. There were fish called alewives in Michigan, and there was coho salmon. Le Grand Charles appeared at Expo and alienated many a Canadian. Lester Pearson called it quits. A pound was devalued. There was Louis Washkansky and a transplanted heart. There were Red Guards, and a Pope visited Fatima, and there was a marriage of a Marine and a maiden in the East Room. The hours catalog a year's living, a year's dying, a year's luck. 1967 was no different. For WKNR News, this is Philip Nye.